Hypatia. H-Y-P-A-T-I-A. Hypatia. Do you need another break? You can have a... My pace is your pace. If you're tired and can't concentrate anymore, I quit. I can stop. Whatever you like.
It's okay. I think a little more.
A little bit more. Notice here that nature in this way yields our attention. Our next level of attention is on what we are doing in the context of nature. And in order to objectify, notice that this next level is a level of the occult term is manifestation, and it's a good term. In other words, nature is always going on, but only rarely, like once in a billion times, does it ever manifest. For every billion pairs of particles, there's only one particle that does actually occur. All the rest is a kind of like a phantom energy, which is there, but unseen. This occurrence is mirrored in human beings on the ritual level. And the one particle in a billion that's important to us is the mask that we would make and wear. What would that mask be? It would have two sides. It would be a mask that would face inside as well as facing outside. And you say to yourself, well, how could I make a mask of what faces inside? Because you have the ability to see images that occur from the outside in, just as you have the ability to see images from the inside out. In other words, the imagal mind is a perfect two-way mirror. You can see images both ways. You can even, there are states where you can see both ways at once, in which case no images occur at all. Mm-hmm. But the two mask assignments, which you should now jot down and say, well, we got today, on the 10th of March, we got the assignment to make two masks. One mask is a mask of some food or some drink from your diet that you take into yourself, take into your body. And the second mask is a mask of a feeling that you recognize as characteristic that comes from you and characterizes your comportment to other people or to the outside world. These two masks will fit together, and there will be an interface, perhaps not an inner space right away, but an interface which can be later developed into an inner space between the two. And the inner space will become increasingly a symbolic relation. It increasingly becomes the symbolic relation upon which the deep self, your deep self, will be founded. And you say to yourself, well, I always thought that everything existed since eternity. Well, that's right. It does. And from eternity, you've had this opportunity to now manifest yourself exactly as you are. In other words, it's not only eternal, But it is, in a complementary way, also extremely objective now. The pristine exactness of the existential moment is, in fact, a cosmological constant. One has to speak in this way, think in this way. But if you think only in this way, using this kind of language, this leads to ideation prematurely. It's like in the Thursday night lecture, Parmenides, the old Parmenides tells the young Socrates, you've got everything it takes, boy, except experience. You're bringing everything together too soon. You've got to let it cook a little longer. And Socrates says, well, Parmenides, what are you talking about? And Parmenides says, you need to have preliminary education. Because without the preliminaries, nothing advanced can occur at all. So that what we are doing is not only preliminaries, but the preliminaries themselves are making the space which later on will be used. It's the whole reason, the whole rationale for a sacred circumambulation. A sacred circumambulation makes the center occur because you're circumambulating. It doesn't matter where you are. If you go through that sacred circumambulation, you make that center sacred. Man has that privilege and that right. He can sacralize any focus that he commits himself to. Man has that freedom. That's real freedom. It's the religious core of man's nature. He has the privilege and the right to sacralize anything that he deems worthy. In ritual, we'll see, with the two masks, that the way to bring the two masks together is to have a single ceremony using these two masks together. And that single ceremony of relating the inner world and the outer world together, that single ceremony will have a medicinal effect. I don't want to say just healing. That has sort of a New Age connotation. A medicinal effect. What is the medicinal effect? It will be a trigger for language to begin to generate meaning. In other words, as soon as what you say begins to have traction in terms of meaning, another level of transformation is available to you that was not available until just then. The only level of transformation that was available before was nature. Now, another level of transformation will be available, the mythic horizon of language. And when man adds that transformational value of language to the transformational value of nature, for the very first time, he has parallels that he can work with. He is able to make conscious to himself paredness between nature and language. And even though sometimes late thought reduces all of this down and says, oh, well, words stand for things. That's like a kindergarten mistake for the more primordial activity of the parid occurrence. Notice that the things don't always have a word which imitates them, but sometimes words are primordial and things imitate them. It can go both ways. There can be such a thing as a creative word. Then man is capable of that. What Wallace Stevens, in one of his poems, Asides on the Oboe, says, thou art not August, unless I say, make thee so. Or in the idea of order at Key West, he and a friend are watching this woman walk along a seashore, and she's singing a song, and they're trying to understand, what is real here, what is real? And he writes something like, she walked as she sang, and the song she sang became the sea, and whatever self it had was what she singing made. It's a wonderful, precise American Zen way of understanding exactly what's going on now. And it can work that way. But the fulcrum is not a power struggle of whether nature is stronger or language is stronger, but the deeper synthesizing insight that language and nature are parallels in a context which is very broad. Because nature will have a complement in an anti-nature, not an antithetical bad nature, but an anti-nature, and language will have its complement also in an anti-mythical. So that myth will imply the possibility of a history, and nature will imply the possibility of a magic. And when one gets to that level of comprehension, you understand that there are four. There's a quaternary of transformational media. A human being becomes very protean indeed. Has incredible ambidextrous qualities of freedom. And to limit oneself to some little mean, brutish wedge of opinion is simply inhumane. Is not just incorrect, it's inhumane. And so the old hermetic image is that of the helper, the companion, reaching a hand down to pull the other out of the pit. You don't have to stay down there. Come up and be free. Come on up out of it. That kind of a quality. But right now, where we are, what's important for us is to savor how nature in its transformational quality has this yin and yang, not as an idea, but as an operating experiential quality. So I put these figures up here. I usually keep them on my desk. My old spirit mother gave these to me. Madame Valda. She told me one time, she said, you know, she said, this is the real yin and yang. This is the real Tai Chi. Work and study. So forget the diagrams, but go and do exactly that. So what we're understanding here, Chinese civilization lost track of the ideas' meanings, but preserved in the people themselves, in the ritual comportment towards life, the esoteric meanings all the time, unbroken. Where do you find the primordial nourishment mandala in Chinese life? At the supper table. The core of Chinese life is eating the meals. That's the hearth of Chinese civilization. That's why Chinese cooking, Chinese cuisine, Chinese food is so protean. Because it is the perfect expression in a colloquial, worldwide way of what's esoterically real in the Chinese view of life. And you can see this. Generally, somebody who, if you ever see a Taoist getting set to order meals for you, the first thing they'll do is take off their coat and roll up their sleeves. The symbol of going to work to do this for everyone, to make this meal happen for everyone. So there's that kind of equality that's here. Next week I'm going to go back to the galaxies and back to Tao physics. Now in Tao physics, I wish you'd take a look at pages 60 to 81. If you could do that. 60 to 81. And pay particular attention to the middle of page 70. And the top of page 72. In the middle of page 78. And then the middle of page 81. Now in the middle of page 81, you will see Capra expressing, in my estimation, quite adequately here, why traditional concepts lose their meaning in late 20th century thought. Lose their meaning. How do they lose their meaning? There's a mythological leak. Where does the energy go? The energy leaks from the mythology and seeps into the history. Now, if you're suffering from the terror of history syndrome, you balk at this. You dig your spurs and you say, hell no, we won't go. We want our bliss. And so your password becomes, I want to find a myth to live my life by. Well, no one ever lived a life by a myth. If you find a myth that powerful, it will live you. Believe me. Talk about being possessed. A good myth can take over a whole life and you don't have to do anything at all, but it'll take care of everything, including your freedom. So Capra here, in this sequence, also jump over to page 109. Where he talks about hexagram interpretations of the I Ching in a language charged with mythical images which are often difficult to understand. Well, why are they difficult to understand? Because they're not charged with mythical images at all. They're charged with symbolic images, which are quite different from mythical images. As we'll see when we get to mythology, a mythic figure is meant to manifest feeling, whereas a symbolic image is meant to manifest meaning. And they flow in different ways, because meaning leads to thought. It gives body to thought. And feeling begins to evaporate a little bit. I'm saying it as nicely as I can. It's not that feeling is gone, but it's that the energy of tension that was there in feeling shifts to another foot. It shifts to thinking. And if it's done just right, with care in your development, you can see how there is a balance between thinking and feeling, where they're both there together at the same time with similar, if not the same, weight. So that what one does from that balance, one really does. It's like somebody learning karate and learns how to balance themselves and to throw a punch from a certain inner balance that you can put your hand through. Whatever's there, side of a bowl, a brick wall, whatever it is. The same way that what one does in life gains an incredible penetrating amperage. As the jazz musician would say, when you lay it down, it stays. It stays done. This kind of a quality is that deep self doing, and it has resonance, so that whatever is done in that level, in that method, has a characteristic tone of balance to it that you is always there, and one can pick up even eons later. There it is. That was done right. This is done exactly right. It's like Paul Horn being in the Taj Mahal and playing a note on the flute, and it doesn't bounce off anywhere but hangs in the space of the building as long as the vibration lasts. It's that kind of a quality. So we're looking for that, and on page 109 of the Tao of Physics will be Capra running against the limitations of his own background. And you need to see that. This is an excellent book. An excellent person. The limited person. The limited book. You need to see that. You need to understand that that's true. And why that's true. So that on page 113, when he notes that Taoism is mystically oriented, you have to take that with a grain of salt. It isn't mystically oriented. It's oriented to an exactness, which seems mystical if you're not participating. The same way that nuclear physics looks mystical to people that don't understand modern mathematics. How can you do this? I remember the first time in Berkeley of going in and seeing the blue-white star of the light of the reactor under the liquid and thinking, realizing that's a living light. There's no way that that's a mechanical light. That is a living light like a star. Look at that. Human beings can manifest a star in a tub. Complex, large tub. Nevertheless, there it is. What in the world are we that we could do that? It's incredible. Some of the early low-power lasers, you could run your hand through the light and have an odd quality of almost being caressed. Very, very peculiar. That physical reality on those levels has a light tone. Not mechanical at all. No one has tinker-toyed this together. This is happening. And so we know that man certainly is a creator. It isn't because of mystical orientation, but because of exactness. Anyway, that's on 113, and then you might read to 116, where he talks about, finally, the perspective relativity of opposites. And you might keep in mind here Niels Bohr's great notion of complementarity. At the end of next year, we'll get to Niels Bohr. We'll get to the principle of complementarity in nuclear physics, and by that time in science, you'll be able to see what Bohr and his genius was writing, what he was talking about. He's a very, very great mind, like a Leibniz. And then there's a little rundown between 121 and 126 on Zen. That's nominal. Now, if you do this with the Tao of Physics, you'll be able, I think, to hear what I'm saying a little bit better. In other words, I'm starting to speak now in such a way as to lift my words off the page of the mind. I'm not speaking from my mind to your mind as I was before, but I'm putting the words out Italian family style in the middle. But there's no bowl there unless you look at your textbook. And if you look at your textbook, that will be the bowl. And I'm going to throw the language into that bowl next week as much as I can to give you a chance to test yourself and see, can I hear anything? It's just a test case. It doesn't have to happen right away. You're just beginning. You're only a couple of months into the process, but you never can tell. Okay, one last thing, a note of business. The film of Moby Dick came, and they sent us the kids' version instead of the version that we ordered. Instead of the $53 version, they sent us a $19 version for kids. So I have to take it back and get it all done again. If there are some of you that haven't put your $2 in for that, that's what that little silver cup is for. We decided that we would all put $2 in to get this film, the John Huston film of Moby Dick, which is a very fine film. The screenplay is by Ray Bradbury, and Gregory Peck does a pretty good job of bringing Ahab's personality out. But this children's version is not appropriate for us. We're cosmic kids. We need to play in reality. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, John.